Welcome to the Kraken Backs podcast, where we zero in on the mechanics of movement and the science of pain relief. Today, we're cutting into the core of anterior cruciate ligament, ACL, injuries, a topic that strikes the lives of up to 200,000 individuals in the U.S. annually, and with a notable majority being female athletes. With us is David Boyer, a leading figure in rehab, strength and conditioning, who is here to unravel the complexities of ACL treatment paths from a non-surgical approach to the intricacies of knee surgery. David will dissect the best practices for returning to the game post-ACL injury, weighing the accelerated against traditional rehab methods. We'll dig into the specifics of return to play testing and what the numbers say about the risk of re-injury. David will also share his insights on the debate around intense rehab routines. Can more actually be better without leading to overuse? We'll discuss how to tailor recovery expectations across the spectrum, from pro athletes to those who play for the love of the game. And we'll explore the emerging trend of using the distal quadriceps tendon in ACL repairs, as well as its potential to revolutionize recovery outcomes. For anyone with their eye on knee health, whether you're a clinician, athlete, or just a plain knee-conscious person, this episode is your playbook for the latest in ACL recovery science. Let's dive in. Welcome back, David. Welcome back, David Boyer.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me back. I love doing this stuff with you guys. Anytime to share information and get some more knowledge, both from you guys and to put it out there, is very exciting for me.
Well, you know, it pays to be the premier ATC, CSCS, and Masters in Psychology. So maybe you can give us a quick analysis about our co-host, Terry Wyman.
We don't have that kind of time.
He's from California. What else right? Do you need to say?
I think there that says it all right there, baby. All right.
Actually, I think his mayor needs a cross-examination.
You mean that's governor, mayor, whatever.
I mean governor, yeah. Governor. Sorry.
We're not going politics. Let's just stick with the damn knees.
Yeah. So, Dave, you dazzled us on our last program, and Dr. Terry, you know, he called and texted me. He said, "Man, I love that kind of stuff," and we heard it from a few other people that listened in. So I want to start out right out talking about knees and ACL injuries, and I understand a recent study in 2023 stated that the incidence of ACL injuries occurs between 100,000 and 200,000 times in the United States. That's a wild statistic. So I'm sure you see most of those. But raising the ACL injury rates now affects. Yeah, right, right. One in 3,500 people in one study and 78 in 100,000. It's crazy. So when it comes to gender, females account for 72%, while men are at 25% across the board. Yeah. That's a big deal, Dave. Let's start off with that. And what criteria do you use for surgical versus non-surgical ACLs, and how long do you suggest rehab would be?
Yeah, well, obviously I'm not a doctor, but I'm gonna extrapolate a little bit on the information that you have, because there's some stuff that I read. If you look at the total youth population, let's say 13 to 21, all right, 10 million, or well, let's go 13 to let's go 13 or let's go, what was it? I think it was 8 to 18-year-olds, 10 million youth athletes, okay? Of the ACLs, there's probably 300,000 surgical interventions of ACLs. And the majority of those, are the female athlete, all right? So the way that the ACL occurs is either non-contact or contact. 75% of ACLs are non-contact, meaning that there's no external force involved with tearing the ACL. It's just something that happened while they were deaccelerating, running, changing direction. 25% of those are contacts. And again, the female athlete is more susceptible to the ACL injury than the male athlete. And that, we'll talk a little bit about why that is. But those are the statistics that I've seen recently of ACL injuries that occur in just the youth population, just the youth. And again, like we said, most of those are females. I think they're 4 to 6 times more susceptible to an ACL injury than their male counterparts.
That's nuts. Do you think that's because now, I mean, this is just a stab at the statistics here. More women's soccer has become so popular, even though it's non-contact. But what do you think?
I mean, there is some studies out there, and I haven't dwelled into too much of that. But I've talked to a coworker of mine, and he seems to think that the ACL injury in the female athlete, and I don't know if I necessarily agree with it, but there's more involved. There's more women playing, so it seems like there's more. Mm-hmm. But the men athlete, like the football players, actually suffer more ACLs also regarding the population that's in the group of that athletic activity. So, yes, I think there's more females, but then I think there's more females involved in those sports. And then them being so susceptible to the ACL injury has a lot to do with like 4 other factors, only one that we can control. And, you know, that's something that we'd probably like to touch on as we go through this process. But if you look at the ACL in its structure and the way it attaches, you know, the ACL is actually stops tibial translation, and it supports the rotational aspect of the knee. It gives it support through that valgus varus rotation stuff. And there's actually 2 bundles to the ACL. There's an anterior medial bundle that it's tight in knee flexion, and then there's a posterior lateral bundle that gets tight in knee extension. So the femoral attachments are to the posterior medial surface of the lateral femoral condyle, and they kind of go up there and attach 2 different bundles, but obviously they come back down into 1. And the tibial attachment is actually in the front of the tibial spine and lateral to it, anterior to the tibial spine and lateral to it. And like when you go through those motion, that lock home mechanism, that's where that ACL is supporting all those mechanical movements or the biomechanics of that. And it's unique because the ACL also attaches to the transverse medial ligament, and it's attached to also the anterior attachment of the anterior portion attaches to the lateral meniscus. So the anterior transverse ligament holds that meniscus down.
Yeah.
You know, so some of that attachment, I mean, unless you're pulling it off the bone, it probably is not going to disrupt that, because most of those ACLs tear in the mid substance of it. Yeah. And so they tear across the middle aspect of it. Hmm. But if you get a severe enough one and it goes in there, it can actually lift the meniscus off the bone by disrupting that transverse ligament across the to hold the patella, or I'm sorry, to hold the meniscus down. Beautiful. So there's a lot going on. It's not just a knee injury. You know, there's a lot that small little structure does for the function of the knee.
I want to ask you about your suggestions for rehab and how you what criteria you use to determine surgical correction. But before you answer that, I have a thought about that I'd rather you answer first. We were talking about provocative factors for what, you know, stresses the ACL. We've been hearing a lot about turf versus ground. Mm. And Dr. Terry spoke with a guy, a chiropractor who is with a high school team. And he reached out to me and asked if I have any research on it. Now, there is research out there, and it does favor ground versus turf. But what are your thoughts on that before you answer the surgical rehab question?
Well, I mean, I hear the same thing you hear. You know, I tore it on turf. I tore it on ground. I don't know. I haven't done enough research or investigation on where most of them occur. Mm-hmm. But I think if you look at the 4 factors – like I talked about, what I mentioned earlier is that the environment that you play in is very difficult in the sense of the control, whether it's the turf or the ground. You know, if you're playing on turf and you're like, oh, I'm not going to play today because it's turf. I mean, that's out of your control. Mm. You know, I mean, it's in your control. You can say, I'm not going to play, but then, you know, you're not going to do that more than likely because there's other things that you can have influence on associated with decreasing the ACL by understanding, you know, one, what is the ACL, and two, what are the factors that can contribute to it? So the environmental factor, I don't think, is playing a big role. Maybe deeper in, as we go into it, the research aspect, all these turf fields might get changed to grass, but ACLs are still occurring on the grass, okay? So the other thing is that if you look at the ACL and things that you can't control is the anatomical structure of how you develop in your skeletal system. And, you know, one study was done on the width of the notch, you know, between the femoral condyles and the attachment. Maybe the ACL is a little bit longer in some people as opposed to other people. But those, again, are things that you can't control. And the other thing is through the development, we talked about the female athlete, the Q angle that occurs, you know, because as these young athletes, these female athletes go and mature, their body's changing, you know. So the Q angle is another thing that you're not going to change that. All right. So there's three things. There's, you know, two categories, anatomical environment that you have no control over. But there's three things in that in just those two categories that you have to deal with. You know, and as the female athlete, if we just stay with the female athlete, we got to look at the hormonal aspect that changes, as they're maturing, you know, and the cycle that they go through, you know, once that transition occurs. I mean, there's studies on there that the progesterone and the estrogen actually create laxity, which we could understand that, create laxity in the ligamentous structures of the female athlete. And we all know why, but these athletes can't stop playing just because they're in that cycle of their development, you know, on a monthly basis. So we have to make sure, and I don't know if enough people are looking at that, but you're not going to miss, you know, seven female athletes because they're in this system of maturing and they're going through that process. So the one thing that we can do is really focus on the biomechanical aspects of what we can control, you know? So the quad is usually dominant in female athletes. So we have to work the posterior chains, the hamstrings, which the hamstring attaches on the tibia and actually controls anterior translation of the tibia during functional movement or sport-specific exercise. We have to look at the core because, as we talked, you know, previously about that bowl of soup concept, you know, there's 29 muscles that attach to the core itself to hold stability in the spine or the lower lumbar or the spine attached to the pelvis to keep that what's called neutral pelvis. And then we have to look at the you know, how we're training, you know, the neuromuscular aspect as far as proprioception and going into those development of where you need to be as far as a stable base, like we talked about before, and how your body's going to function. I mean, if you're quad dominant and you're not doing hamstrings, I'm not talking a Nordic, you know, exercise that they do or a hamstring curl on the machine. I'm talking, you know, functional feet on the ground, closed change mechanics, or activating your core through a posterior chain, you know, bridge while you're engaging some of those, you know, those hamstring exercise to create that whole unit that we talked about as far as core stability. So, I mean, there's those four things, you know, anatomical, environmental, hormonal, and biomechanical is the thing that I think you really have to focus on. To really stay on what you can control to prevent ACL injuries.
Super, super. And back to the other question about, you know, rehab and what you might determine surgical correction. Because I got to tell you, man, these days I'm starting to be very cautious about what orthopedics say. They run an MRI and they go, oh, we need to clean up your knee and clean up, and then you're off for 6 weeks. So what surgical What's your determinant for surgical intervention? Do you have one?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of that goes to the subjective information you get from the patient, or the, let's say it's athlete, from the athlete and what they're going. But I mean, a competitive athlete, and as we talked, you know, the function of the ACL is this all stability and control to create functional movement. But as a competitive athlete, if you have a ACL injury, whether it's a partial tear or a full thickness tear, I think the likelihood, depending on what age you're at and how we, you know, where you want to go as far as your career, the likelihood of having a surgical intervention is 100%. Because I don't think you can, I do not think you can function at the level that you think you want to function by not having an ACL intervention through a surgical intervention to stabilize that knee.
Jeez.
I mean, I've seen some of the things like, oh, I healed this ACL and, you know, just by without surgery. But we never know how much of a tear it was, where it was. Was it just one of the bundles that tore? Or, you know, I mean, when I first got back into the private sector, they were doing double bundle repair ACLs, and I was like, what is that?
Yeah.
You know, and they never worked. You know, they the failure rate was astronomical from what my own perception of what these individuals had to go through. You know. So I think you have to really dig deep and go back to what's been working for such a long period of time. You know, like you were mentioning something about the quad. I've seen probably 2 quad ACLs in the last 10 years, 12 years, you know, where they do that autograft of the quad itself.
Yeah.
You know, 7 years ago, when I first got out of pro sports, they were doing the hamstring. But in my understanding, if the hamstring is the thing that helps support the, you know, control the anterior translation of the tibia, why would you want to take the hamstring? So that's just me thinking out loud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I always go back to the patella tendon. Mm-hmm. I mean, 30 years ago, that's what they did. That was the gold standard. Let's do the patella tendon. And now they say they don't want to involve the extensor mechanism of the knee itself. But yeah, I mean that the quad is going to pull into a transier or you know the tibial translation forward, but the hamstrings are going to control it. So what's the less of two evil in my mind? So I mean, if I can extrapolate on this, you know, the autograft is a hamstring, patella tendon, quad tendon. All right. The allograft is all that irradiated, non-irradiated cadaver stuff. So in studies, the autograft had a failure of 6%, and the failure rate of the allograft was for non-irradiated, I think I'm saying there, irradiated, was 9%, and the irradiated was 34%.
Oh, God.
And that was a study done, let me think what it was. I can't remember the year, but it was 2011 or something like that. You know, then in a different study, you know, they always say that there's significant failure in youth athletes in using a cadaver ligament. Now, what significant is, I don't remember what that is. But then there's a systematic review of 7 different studies with 788 autografts and 288 allografts with the age of 21 and 9.6 failure rate in the autografts, which is their hamstring and, you know, excuse me, patella, and a 25% failure rate in the allograft, cadaver ligament. So and I think in that same study there was a longer study related to it, which indicated that the patella tendon, so the autograft for the patella tendon, was better than the hamstring tendon. So with that information, I mean, if it's my kid,
yeah,
listen, you're going to get it fixed because you're a good athlete and you're, you know, whatever, 14 years old, and you're going to use your patella tendon, you know?
Yeah.
So, which you can control that a little bit more now as you go through the physical therapy aspect of things.
Right.
So I don't know if that answers your question.
Oh, it does.
Too much.
No. There's this new thing that some of our peers are doing, and it's a prehab. Prehab. So if you're destined to get ACL surgery, some of them are entertaining this preparation for the event of surgery. So do you guys do any of that, or do you?
Well, is it acute injury? I mean, what are we talking about prehab? I want you to go to therapy for 4 weeks before we do the surgery.
Yeah.
Sure. Because if you have edema, mm-hmm. after a significant and isolated, mm-hmm. I'm just talking isolated ACL injuries, mm-hmm. you know, on all this information, because meniscus and all that stuff changes everything. But if you have a significant enough ACL injury, you're going to have edema. You're going to have a limited range of motion due to the edema. You're going to have muscle fatigue. So, yes, the prehab aspect of things is to keep the muscle active, control the swelling, you know, keep your range of motion going. Again, isolated ACL, not a meniscus that's catching and pinching and limiting your extension or whatever it is. Not that you can not have limited range of motion with an isolated ACL. But yeah, I think the prehab aspect is you want to get them to be as good functionally as they can possibly be before you go in and surgically repair that thing. Because you're going to have more activation in your muscle. You're going to have controlled edema that's, you know, it's going to be less. You're going to have good range of motion. So prehab, yes, I think you should do it. Now, you know, it's up to the athlete, but the doctor's going to really control that. You know, I think a lot of doctors, and I think like you said, they're doing a little bit more prehab to get everything prepped.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a psychological aspect to it too, but you still have to present that to the athlete in the sense of like, listen, we're going to do prehab. You're going to get an idea of what you're going to go through. You got to start laying that path to you know, proper healing, recovery, and so you can get back into sports. Now, I know one thing we'll probably touch base on is the acceleration rehab aspect of things. Mm-hmm. Is that part of the acceleration rehab aspect of it? Yes, possibly. Because now I know where I'm at. I know what I'm doing. I don't have to come to therapy and go like, what am I doing here? Like, right. I'm never going to play again, you know?
Yeah.
So I think the prehab aspect of things is, yeah, it serves a two purpose, physically and the mental aspect of it, to get them prepared for what's going to come.
What are you saying to these unfortunate athletes that get these ACL tears or need the surgery? Are you, what is your return to play criteria when they say, you know, when you tell them or give them an objective, because they're going to ask you, when can I go back?
Yeah, but they get so much information, you know, it's sometimes it's a shame, you know, like, they want to come back in 7 months. They want to come back in 8 months. You know, so let's look at the healing process.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. let's look at the healing process. So you go in and you have an ACL surgery. The fact is that you're going in now. You're going to take your patella tendon. You're going to disrupt your patella tendon. You're going to attach it to two bones. Well, the first week you get into that avascular necrosis aspect of things, and we all know that in a hip. If you're avascular, you're having a total hip replacement, right? I mean, that's just things got to get disrupted before they get aligned to be in place to have the proper healing, you know. And then you're going to get the revascularization aspect of it between, I think it's 3 to 20 weeks, which is fine. That's a process that occurs. So 20 mm-hmm. weeks is what, 4 months?
Yeah.
4.5 months?
Yeah.
And that's okay. That's the healing process. But in those 23 to 20 weeks, that 6 to 12 week is when all this graft disorganizes all the collagen and it doesn't know what it's supposed to be doing. So that's the weakest point. So, but a lot of these kids don't understand that. And the parents, if they're young enough, need to be informed of it. So that that basic, you know, 6 to 12 weeks is when everything's starting to fall in place. but it's still at its weakest point at that point, or at that cycle or that stage. You know, and then what you get is you get past that 3 months, which is 4, 8, 12. You know, then you get into the 20 aspect of it. You start doing more, call it sports specific movements, but it's not playing sports. Right. You know, so that progression to skill training starts at 24 weeks. Hmm. I always tell everybody, listen, you got a year, okay? You got a year because that in 12 months, that graft is only 80% healed. So at 6 months, and there's a chart. I wish I had it. I would brought, you know, I would have showed you whatever. But at 6 months, it's only 50% healed. So these kids, and they watch like these pro athletes coming back at 6 months, you know, one in whatever, 790 pro football players or whatever it is. Yeah. That's an outlier. Okay. Well, this guy did it in 6 months and he's playing in the NFL or whatever. I think, who was it? Adrian Peterson or something like that.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's like, yeah, but you're like 15 years old. Okay. So slow down. So I always tell them, listen, you got 12 months. Okay. Yeah. How you do in the beginning, you can take a little bit off, but at 12 months, you're still only percent. And there's a study out there that after a year, after you progress through an ACL after a year, anytime after a year, the likelihood of having a re-injury is decreased. Mm-hmm. So if my daughter or son is playing soccer, I'm telling them right out, you got 12 months. And if I can hold them back for 12 months, then I'll open the gate at 12 months and let them go. Mm-hmm. But most of these kids want to come back. They want to, and you're going to have a significant increase of a likelihood of a re-tear or a tear on the uninvolved side.
Yeah.
And that's all related to just not giving the love to that uninvolved side. So those are the things that I lay the foundation on. And then we can go through, you know, other return to play stuff once they come out of therapy and we see where they're at. But even the therapeutic aspect and going through that process needs to be expressed and informed to them and let them know what they need to get through as far as the physical therapy aspect and where they should be at a certain time to get back into, you know, what I say. I'd like to take them all at 3 months and put them, you know, in the post-PT program, you know, because I think some of the therapy, and again, it's based on how the information is transferred back and forth between the athlete and the therapist and how their healing process goes. But I think a lot of them want to keep them, I shouldn't say that, not want to keep them, but think they have to keep them a little bit longer, you know. So I'd like to see more, three and a half months get pushed to a good post PT, you know, ACL recovery program.
Do you base your opinion on return to play on any particular test, though? I mean, or, you know, range of motion or a strength or maybe running, or what do you think?
Well, the return to play, let's look at the psychological aspect first. I mean, I think it's Arden and colleagues did a study that 44 to 55% are the only group that return to competitive sports after an ACL injury. So you think about that, you know. Yeah. We think about, and you know, when I don't know what the guideline is, oh, they came back or they played at a lesser level, or they didn't. My understanding is they didn't get back to where they were of the competitive nature of what they're doing. All right. So return to play in the physical therapy setting, I think you look at the subjective stuff as far as how they're feeling. Mm-hmm. You look at the side-to-side deficit of muscle activation. You look at functional aspect, a hop test. And there's a few hop tests. There's one for distance. There's one for crossover. You correlate single leg balance, you know, between the involved and uninvolved. And I think they used to do that with the, remember the isokinetic machines for peak torque.
Yeah.
But there's a comparison between, I can't remember his name right now, but a comparison between those extension of peak torque at 120 and 180 degrees has a correlation between a single hop test for distance. So, I mean, that's out there. That's already there. And then there's, you know, you can do, obviously look at where they're at. Mm-hmm. You know, is it joint effusion at 6 months? Then there's an issue, which I think I'd mentioned. I had a young lady who's having issues 18 months out.
Yeah.
And she was, wanted to get back into competitive sports. You got to look at the range of motion. You got to look at the different leg symmetry, like side to side, like I mentioned. But one thing I think people miss out on is what's happening below the joint. Now you got to remember, you have ankle mobility. You know, if you have limited extension and you go into a running program or progression to a running program, you are more susceptible to gaining or getting arthritic conditions at a earlier stage. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the key for the physical therapy aspect, and when we get into physical therapy, is to control the swelling, control the edema, you know, use the range of motion to get that extension, because you've got to get full quad activation to get full extension to decrease the likelihood of earlier onset of arthritic condition. You have to get, knee flexion. I mean, the goal is to get knee flexion by the fourth week at 90 degrees full knee flexion in 4 to 6 weeks and 90 degrees in the first week. Mm. And the patella mobilization, because if you've taken the patella tendon, things are scarring down. Well, if the kneecap doesn't glide superiorly, you're not going to get full quad activation. Therefore, you're not going to get full extension. All right. Mm-hmm. So you're going to miss out on that screw home mechanism, which gives that knee stability where everything comes together at the same time to lock full extension to possibly avoid a hyperextension or an increased rotational injury, therefore creating an ACL. So there's a lot of things that you have to look at in the physical therapy aspect and then promote that to that recovery or post-PT recovery ACL. But even on the progression, they say you can progress this running gait or running patterns or running progression at 4 months. But if you don't have full extension, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, like if somebody comes to me without full extension and the PT says, hey, they can do this running, I'm going to say in my head, because we all have to, you know, have respect for other people, but it's like, no, let's do this first, you know, and how's your running progression going? It's going to go straightaways. It's going to go curves. You're going to build up to it. If you have swelling in there, then you got to go backwards, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's a good way to progress through the running that everybody wants to get into, because obviously your legs are meant to run.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's one sport other than swimming or horseback riding, something like that, that you're not on your feet.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, the big sports, let's say.
Right.
And then you keep progressing, but your progression into your running is really a functional evaluation as you go through it to determine whether you're limited your range of motion, your hip, you know, Trendelenburg kind of thing, because your lateral glutes weak, or, you know, you get swelling or pain. That's how the progression back in, but I think you still have to have the foundation understanding what all this ACL stuff is.
Are you seeing a lot of re-injury by any chance?
There's a lot of re, but I think there's a lot because they want to come back too early.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh,
I mean,
right.
I see, you know, there's, especially against the female athlete, their uninvolved side gets involved.
Yeah.
I think we have to think as professionals, like, hey, you're going to do single leg bridges on your involved side. I want you to do them on your uninvolved side. You're going to, you know, when you get into that proprioception balance, posterior chain activity for neutral pelvis.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that we are really, as professionals, we are really on these young athletes to really properly put the mechanics in place And that may be because we have to hurry them through. We, you know, we got to see another patient. There's just the time. I think we could spend a little bit more time making sure that these kids are set in their foundation to come back the way that they should be coming back.
Do you, do you find that there, if you don't perform some of these tests that you would typically do, can they re-injure if they're, obviously they could re-injure if they go back too fast, but, you know, there are certain activities that they are prohibited from doing once they start back to a little more, you know, like their you know, practice or anything. You find you have to limit them. Let's say like a soccer player or where, you know, are you just having them run linear and then waiting to do side to side or anything like that?
Yeah, you got to go through the full gamut of that functional testing to see how they respond. Like just because I'm 12 months and if I never ran or jogged a straight line or did a, you know, curls or S's or even a little bit of a crossover, like your stage has to be, like you said, linear to horizontal, just like your stage and plyometric aspect of things has to be. This is the way I do it. You take a jump. I know everybody can jump. Not everybody, but you know what I'm saying? The mechanics of it have to be there.
Yeah.
But you're not just going to go and do a jump, which is 2 feet, like a jump. You're going to jump. You're going to slow it down. You're going to feel the tension on the muscle. You're going to feel the shin come over the top. So your jump is going to be a jump, feel the mechanics of it, jump again. You know, that would be like a phase one for me. And that could be a month. It could be, you know, it could be 3 weeks. It could be 2 weeks, depending on what the observation is that I see. And then we can do a jump. And then what we can do is we can get into a bound, you know, but the bound still has to start linear and then we can go horizontal and then we can get into a hop, which is same leg. But again, the same leg still has to go linear before you can do a horizontal, before you can change any type of height, you know, as a plyometric. So the running progression is going to be the same way, you know, linear. You know, linear S, you know, that kind of thing until you can get into crossovers. So when the athlete's 12 months, they should already have done all that stuff. Like I shouldn't send an athlete back to their team to get functionally tested on whether they can play, you know, because a trainer, you know, unless I'm the trainer of that team, I'm already doing that stuff. So the trainer should be, hey, thanks a lot. Is she ready to go? Yes. This is what it is. Okay. Because he's busy taking care of all the other stuff, you know? Yeah. And it's, you have to progress these kids by neutral pelvis, by stiff spines, slowing motions, forward, backwards, right to left, and then get them into their skill aspect of things where they can, like I have a girl doing soccer, not skills, but dribbling, which is fine. She's 5 months, but she's stationary doing it. So that's okay. There's no rotational stuff going on. There's no, you know, impacting going on. It's just touching the ball again, you know, and that's okay. That's that, what that does psychologically, it gets her closer to her goal.
Right.
What that does physically allows her to accept where she's at.
Yeah.
So in my mind, that's the way I look at it. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a progression that we all miss out on because we all want to live in the future. And then when we get to the future, we don't like what we did.
Right.
So now we're going to live in the past and I should have done this kind of thing, you know?
Yep.
So, I mean, that's the same way I do. That's the same way I try to express everything, whether it's physical, whether it's mental, you know, you have to know where you're at.
Yeah.
Before you can know where you're going.
Go. Very good.
I got a question, you know, and across the board, not just youth athletes, but college, you know, middle age pros, all the way up into the older athlete. What's your opinion on speeding up some of the recovery based on if time is not a factor on multiple workouts per day? So, for example, 3 to 5 hours of rehab, stretching, training that spread out throughout the day compared to that 1 hour PT appointment. But assuming overuse injuries, avoiding that we're not doing overuse or anything like that.
Do you have PT as part of that 3 to 5 hour block?
Yes.
Okay, so that's, you can break that down into, like, if I put it on a piece of paper, you come in, okay, we're going to work on your mobility, flexibility. Boom, that takes 40 minutes. Now I want you to go to PT and work on your injury, you know, get some hands-on, get some manual, get some range of motion, get some scar tissue stuff taken care of. You know, you've already done, call it the foam roller before, so you're in there. Start your core activation in your PT, come out of PT and go to your strength and conditioning aspect of things where you're working general strength. But even my general strength would be like, I'm going to take some of your PT, start you in the general strength, but focus on the PT, like core activation, continue with your balance before I get you into the general strength aspect of things. Once the general strength aspect, depending where your time is and how you're handling all that, you can get into a skill aspect. You know, now, obviously, this is a high level athlete who has nothing to worry about but playing the next game, which might be 6 months away.
Yeah.
This is not a high school kid. This is not a, I mean, even a college kid's probably not going to have that set up. If he does, it's going to be a 3 hour block. Mm-hmm. So if you strategically place it, I think you run a lot less risk of any kind of overuse injury. If you don't, you have a high likelihood to have an overuse injury. If you don't place it in the right spot, there's a great amount of likelihood that you're going to have an overuse injury, in my mind. You know, if you're not doing core activation for the multifidus and those local muscles, the erector spinae, you're going to have an increase. And this was a study done. I'll have to look it up and tell you. But you're going to have an increased likelihood of hamstring strains and hip flexor soreness or strain by not stabilizing what's called those local muscles. Because what happens if you don't stabilize the shearing and the stability aspect of the spine on the pelvis, then those other global muscles, which are your rectus abdominal muscle, your obliques, which control torque, are going to have to give in to the proximal muscles, which control neutral pelvis. Now, you can't control neutral pelvis if your hamstring and hip flexor are sore, because you didn't control the global muscles, which didn't allow you, you didn't control the local muscles, which, you know, I'll work down the line like that. Mm-hmm. So I, like we said before, you always got to look at the inside out, you know, and so you could strategically place it to answer your question. Yes, you can get a 5 hour block without overtraining based on how you chronologically involve it into their daily schedule. But again, that's a highly competitive athlete. That's not a high school kid. That's going to be tough.
And I said, you know, if time wasn't an issue, you know, we could probably speed up, but is it realistic? I don't think so. You know, with time, depending on who you are, right? Is that what you're saying?
Speed up the what? The healing process?
Yeah. Can we speed up the recovery process if time is not an element and we were able to do that block versus that the average person spends what, 1 to 3, 1 hour in PT or therapy 2 to 3 times a week, sometimes 3 to 4 times a week. If time was not a problem, could the recovery time be sped up with a 3 to 5 hour block of doing multiple things, like you said?
Yes, I think you could, because what you engage in is neurological response, and proprioception is a big component of decreasing the likelihood of ACLs and decreasing a secondary ACL. So yes, I think you can. But if you go deeper into the knee, remember what I said earlier, your ACL is only healed at 80% at 12 months out. So do I think you can speed it up from an external aspect as far as muscle stability, central nervous system, you know, proprioception, mechanical receptors of the joint to prevent excess stress on the ACL? I think you could, but you're still going to run a risk of, you know, at 6 months, 8 months, it's only 50% and 80%.
So I think that, yeah, I think you're answering my second question, which, what would you say is the top limiting factor for ACL rehab being successful and staying successful? It's probably what you just mentioned. Would that be correct?
Well, yes. I think you can put an ACL recovery and an ACL prevention program as the same thing. So you have to look at, so the American Journal of Sports Medicine 2007 showed individual with decreased trunk control during functional exercise had decreased trunk control during functional exercise showed decreased proprioception of those mechanical receptors inside the knee, which increases the risk of ACL injuries. So you could treat the prevention program if it's done the right way and a recovery program the same way by utilizing those local muscles of the core to get to your global muscles to get to what you need to get to make yourself better and expedite the recovery aspect. Proprioception is the key of exercises in a functional position to decrease the likelihood of ACLs or injuries in general. As American Academy of Orthopedics showed that neuromuscular training reduced non-contact ACLs, ACL injuries. So neuromuscular proprioception. So to go through it, you have to work your balance, and the balance is visual, sensory, and proprioception. And it's not just single leg balance. Okay. It's not, you got to, you know, like the balance board aspect of things, you have to be in the right position to turn everything on to stabilize the joint. Through core training, which is those 29 muscles, and the posterior chain of the proximal hip to create neutral pelvis position so that spine can sit on there and use those local muscles so you don't have that forward lean of that trunk. So that in itself, yes, you have to do your general strength training squats and all that stuff to control external resistance that's coming at you. But if you're talking just non-contact ACLs, you have to definitely go from the inside out, work the local muscles, the multifidus, all those small spinal stabilizers to the global muscles, which control torque, to the proximal muscles, which control neutral pelvis. All that can be done and should be done in a balanced position for proprioception stimulation, call it. And I think you can expedite your recovery, but you still, especially on these young kids, you still have to look at the graph of how that ACL recovers in itself. And it's out there. 12 months, like I say, I can't stress it enough. It's only 80% healed.
All right. You touched on it earlier of the mental aspect of the injury. So I'm kind of curious, how do you manage the expectations between the professional, the high-performing amateur, both high school and college, and the non-athlete with the knee rehabilitation?
Well, the non-athlete still suffered an injury. So you have to look at the injury as, like, you take everything away. An injury is an injury. It's an ACL injury. You have to look at the individual and see what they've lost because of that injury. Now, the athlete lost the support group of their team. If they're in college, they've lost the support group of their family because they're away. So they've lost two things. The non-athlete has lost their ability to function, whether it's taking care of their family, kid-wise, or, you know, that kind of thing, or going to work. So maybe that's their support structure, going to work, their family, their work. You know, so you have to look at what they've lost to build the foundation of how they can work towards getting back to what they want to do. So that's the first thing. And to get back to what you do, well, let's take the athlete in general. Their biggest concern is the loss of their support, but their fear of re-injury. So that builds your foundation of, okay, how do we establish this to move forward? You know, the return to play fear of athletes is the biggest thing. And we talked about the 44 to 55% are the only ones that came back. What happened to the other percent? Most of them dropped off because of that fear of re-injury. Mm. So the stay-at-home mom or whatever, the dad, you know, not shoveling snow slips on the steps, he still lost his ability to function. So we have to start setting goals for them, you know. I mean, in my mind, it's I don't want to say it's easier for the athlete because I know what they got to get back to, and I don't see too many of the, call them non-athletes, because they don't transfer into me. You know, once they get out of PT, they feel good, I'll be careful, blah, blah, blah. But if it's a weekend warrior, that's an athlete. So you have to begin by understanding, like, okay, let's set a goal. And that's not a goal, I want to get back to sport, because that's very long term. Where do you want to be in a month? How do you want to get there? You got to, I think we talked about this before, shrink the time down, change the mindset to achieve smaller goals, because four small goals is a big goal, you know? So they can see that progression and their success will build upon that in order to get them to where they want to go. So you change the mindset, you establish a direct path based on their goal, and you internally you have to start controlling their thoughts. Am I ever going to get better? My knee's sore today. But you have to give them that information, and then you can go back to like, okay, let's talk about where you want it to go. This is a little setback. So let's visualize what it felt when you were performing at your best. You know, so you control that thought. Let's get a stimulating imagery of a predator that you can become when you have a setback. So now you can move through that. Let's look at what you were doing when you were good. Like, what was your strength? I was a good kicker. I was a good, you know, slap shot. I was a good skater. Okay, so there's your objective. Because you have a little setback, you know, because it's sore, it's going to get sore. It's a process. We have to do steps. But if you use visualization, if you use goal setting, if you use the controlling the emotional aspect of it, like if you get angry because you have pain now or it's swelling up all the time, you're out of your comfort zone of when you need to perform at your best to heal. If you get depressed, you're out of your comfort zone. So how are you going to maintain? And it's like a 5 to 6 out of scale 1 to 10, because that's where you perform your best. So how do you maintain? You get too high, slow down, take a breath, get that neurological system to set in place so you're not so tense. If you're too low, remember your goal, remember your predator. Where do you want to be tomorrow? I want this pain to stop. Okay. Now you have an objective. So don't forget about, or don't think about, you know, that aspect of it's never going to get better. Now you can start focusing on what do I have to do to make it better tomorrow? So, I mean, and it's unique because if you set the mindset in the right direction, those things will take care of themselves. We are creatures that always want to, like I said earlier, you know, we want to change the past and we want to predict the future, something we have no control over, you know. Can we work towards better future? Of course, you know, but things are going to happen. So how resilient are you going to be to get over that, to get to where you want to be or what you want to be or how you want to be, you know?
How often
perfect.
How often are you seeing knee replacement surgery after a quad tendon repair?
Knee replacement?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the quad tendon is a very hard muscle to tear. I mean, you need a very ballistic thing. I think I've only seen like maybe 4 or 5 quad ruptures. One was a bodybuilder who was just squatting too much weight. One actually was a slip and fall after an ACL injury. He was older, not older, but, you know, middle-aged gentleman.
Yeah.
And he actually, I said, where have you been? What happened to you? He said, I had to have another, you know, this is his first day back because we missed him for whatever, a month. I was like, what happened? And he told me he was out getting ready to shovel the sidewalk and he slipped on the water in the garage from coming in. God. And he actually sat there because he couldn't get up for like an hour before his son came home and said, what are you doing? He said, I think I tore my quad. I can't get up. So I don't see too many quad ruptures.
Yeah.
You know, the same as I don't see too many quad tendons used as the ACL.
Yeah.
You know, because I just, it's just, I don't know why. Maybe there's not enough done, you know, where they're coming to me or whatever. But, you know, I mean, it's quad ruptures. Those are tough injuries.
There's a, you know, a controversy or, you know, depending on the surgeon, they'll want to do, they'll either take the hamstring or they'll take, you know, quad tendon or patellar tendon or cadaver or a combination of, you know, synthetic. And do you see any difference? Do you have a preference?
Oh, you're asking me if I have a preference?
Yeah.
Anybody I know is getting a patellar tendon graft.
Right.
You know, what about,
like I said, I mean, when I first came out, they wanted to do something called this double bundle or single bundle, you know, and I never really understood it because I would always be like,
yeah,
what are you doing? Like, just get the patella tendon.
Does you,
well, but people have their reasons, you know?
Well, Dave, like, your second, does your opinion change with the age of the athlete?
Is it an athlete?
Well, or an active person.
No.
The reason I ask that is, you know, when they get to be 40 and 50 and they're still very athletic, you know, we had an orthopedist on the test and he likes using cadavers after the age of 40, mainly because it's younger tissue than their older patella tendon graft. And he found that the younger athlete, they feel so good with that cadaver tendon that they do stupid things and they don't let it to really grain in and lock in, where the older athlete has a little more patience with the work. But he likes using younger tissue with the older athlete. What's your thoughts on that?
I mean, I don't know enough about how they harvest and as far as I know, they radiate that tissue. You know, to kill all the whatever it is they kill.
Yeah.
You know, now can they non-radiate it? Sure. But based on the study regarding athletes, there's a 9.6% failure of the autograft compared to a 25% failure of the allograft, which is the cadaver. He's got a reasoning for it, which is, that's fine. But for me personally, you're taking the patella tendon. I mean, it's just, based on the information that I know, and I'm not saying I know everything, there might be something out there. I've never looked into too much of the cadaver tendon. I always shook my head and was like, why are you doing that? You know, some people don't want to disrupt the extensor mechanism, you know, of the knee itself. But I don't know. I just see so much more, such better results for the patellar tendon graft. Now, if it's a non, you know, athletic individual or, you know, someone can control themselves, like you were saying, they're not as aggressive because they feel so good, it might be good for them, you know. But as far as I'm concerned, personally, this is just personally, everybody that I ask me, I'm going for the patella tendon. And even like you said, I mean, they want to use younger tissue, but how much do they beat it up? Is the healing process the same with the allograft that in the autograft? I mean, that's something that might be looked at, you know, as far as the graph about how it's, I would think that it is because your body's going to heal just because you have a, you know, that different tendon in there. Does one heal faster than the other? I don't think so. I think the graph itself goes through this, you know, this 12-month process, you know, they might feel better because they're not as active, which is fine. And they don't have to deal with, you know, the patella tendon and scar tissue and stuff like that. So they might get better quicker. But again, they're not going to go and play soccer, right? You know, whether you're 40 years old or even a weekend warrior.
Yeah.
I mean, those are my impressions only. Those are my thoughts, I guess. Yeah.
That's why we ask you. But let's go mental. Let's go to the mental component right now and ask about how if a player needs to compete in a couple of days, and you know, what are you your approach to what you're saying to them? That's not an area that we have a specialty in, but is there a higher level approach that you would consider how you would have a conversation with them?
Well, Well, I think you have to leave it on the player. Now, in the past, late 90s when I started it, you never left anything with the player.
Yeah, yeah.
But now you have to, you have to listen. Mm-hmm. You have to go through your physical testing.
Right.
You have to understand their preparedness, and then you can get into the mental aspect of it. Like, I feel like I'm ready. Okay, mm-hmm. You passed the test. Your preparedness is ready. So, have you practiced? Well, no, I don't need to practice. Yes, you do. You know, so you got, I think objectively, you have to look at what they've done, let's say 11, 12, 13 months, or even, you know, let's say it's earlier, let's say it's 9, 10, 11 months.
Yeah.
To really determine, because once you have a setback mentally, they're going to be destroyed. Now you're working even harder to get them back to where they want to go. So what's waiting another week, like we talked about before, compared to being ready for long term? Mm-hmm. So mentally, I think you have to find out where they're at, you know, and you have to make sure you siphon through any external noise that's been beating them down, coaches, parents, teammates, college scouts, all those other things, and make them understand and realize, like, this is yours, okay? You're not expected to know what you're supposed to do mentally, physically, unless you've given the information. So where do you think you are, just between you and I, about playing? And then I think you'll get a real answer. It's like, you know, I really haven't. But you got to give them the information.
Right,
I really haven't practiced. Yeah. I was a little sore after it swelled up a little bit. Or like, listen, I've been here for a week. I've been hitting guys. I've been shooting the puck. I've been kicking the ball. I scored 5 goals in practice yesterday. You know? So I think you have to look at all the information to really give it to them and then make a decision mentally. Because the mental aspect is a thing that can be the worst for you.
Yeah.
Make a decision mentally, all the physical stuff aside, but make a decision mentally of where do you think you're really at?
All right. This has been great. And I'm so glad that you chimed in to ask us to talk about the ACL, because, you know, the stats are just crazy. And now we're in football season. So, and you know, we have soccer season at the college level. We have the female and all that. But I've already seen 2 or 3 ACL injuries just at the high school football level. We didn't do the rapid fire. I know Spencer's really upset about that, but what's your best tip? So I'll give you one rapid fire. What's your best tip for the younger and older athlete to keep from injuring their ACL?
Core activation with a neutral pelvis and a stiff spine through functional movement patterns.
For both?
That's where it all starts. Hmm. For both. I mean, look at a young athlete, like an adolescent. Not a youth. He doesn't even know his body. You know, he's flopping all over. He can't control a neutral pelvis. He doesn't know how to do for a simple exercise, a glute bridge. He can barely get his knee over his toe to get into a good, strong athletic position.
Yeah.
And then or even balance, you know, as a youth, you know, 8 to 13 year old.
Yeah.
And then you take the next group who's kind of evolved a little bit, and they've done a lot of weight training, you know, let's say 14 to 18, they still are not doing proper core activation with a stiff spine to create a neutral pelvis in a functional position. They want to see how much weight they can lift. They want to, you know, they want to do their, what is it, PR, their personal or record. You know, and so I am seeing this. It upsets me so much, because these kids, youth and adolescent, still don't understand the neutral pelvis to control all the movements that occur in the hip, knee, ankle, spine. Like, thoracic spine is where your rotation comes from. It's not your lumbar. Yeah, you get a little bit, but if you want to throw the ball harder, you have to have a locked in base to wrap around that thoracic spine to get that coil effect, to get that object to go. It's the same with shooting a hockey puck. It's the same almost with shooting a soccer ball. Mm-hmm. You still have to have neutral. It's the same with change of direction. You know, am I going to flex over the top and shut my glute off to mush or push laterally? So that's my whole thing is neutral pelvis, stiff spine, in a, you know, balance in a functional position, you know, mm-hmm. to control all that midsection. There's 29 muscles in there that need to work the right way. So those strength and plyometric aspects, the explosion stuff, mm-hmm. can function efficiently. Remember, a weak multifidus gives you a weak hamstring, gives you a weak hip flexor, gives you an unstable, you know, pelvis, which create whatever, strains, tendonitis, whatever it is, inflammation. And that's how you move.
Dave, I don't know, man. You know so much stuff about this ACL. It's great, man. I really appreciate everything. We're going to wrap up on this one and feed the masses with their with your understanding of ACL injuries.
I appreciate you guys letting me come back because this is something I'm really passionate about.
Yeah.
Anytime I can get a chance to share it, I want to share it. You know?
Perfect.
Beautiful stuff. Thanks, Dave.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Cracking Backs podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you follow us on Instagram at Cracking Backs Podcast. Catch new episodes every Monday. See you next time.